Morning. Good morning. It is such a joy for us to return here. We have so many rich, long-standing relationships with people here. So good to see all of you. And also thank you again for your ongoing support. Support you've shown to us for 8 years now since we left Indiana, trading the meticulous care of Wendell Brain for the rabid fanaticism of Buckeye Land, which I'll let you decide which one is more oppressive. I'm still not sure. But we're glad to be back, so thank you all. There is a phrase known to every child of the 80s, like myself. Caulk the wagon and float across. Now, everyone who can recall the day of floppy disk and computer monitors that were deeper than they were wide can remember this game, this phrase in the game that it belonged to. Anyone? There he is, the Oregon Trail, right. I know I'm showing my age, but that's okay. The Oregon Trail. Now, the Oregon Trail is a game that, unlike the flashier adventure games of today, was pretty simple in its concept. You had a covered wagon, you were a leader, and you had to take the wagon all the way from Independence, Missouri to Oregon. Now, inevitably, along the journey, you would encounter a river like this, and you'd be faced with the question of how to get across the river. The game would give you several options. You could attempt to ford the river. You could caulk the wagon and float, like I previously mentioned. You could take a ferry across, pay for it. You could wait around to see if conditions would improve, or you could seek more information. Now, when you were faced with this question, there's no doubt that all of these options have the same goal in mind, to get across the river to the other side to continue along your journey. But in spite of my preference for caulking the wagon and floating across, which I believe is proven to be the best, in spite of that opinion, you can have a hearty debate at any time on what is the best method based on the weather conditions, your funding. Many considerations would come into mind as you determine how to get across. But regardless of which you would choose, you all have the same goal in mind. You want to get across the river to the other side. Your debate is not one of end goal, but rather strategy, how to get across to the other side. But you would have to deliberate fairly quickly, or someone would inevitably die of dysentery or typhoid. But this morning, we're going to consider another debate of strategy, a debate not of nostalgic video games, as much as I enjoy them, but a debate that is a little more complex and a debate within the anti-abortion community. It is a debate within our ranks of what legislation we should pursue. Now, all who engage in this debate agree to the end goal, banning elective abortion. But like travelers on the Oregon Trail, they do not always agree to the best methodology for how to cross the river, how to get to the other side. On one side of the debate, you have those who say that all legislation must be a total ban of all abortion. The other side defends efforts to gradually restrict abortion on the way to that same end goal of total abolition. Now, if you're not familiar this morning with the debate, you probably will be soon. It continues to spring up across the country, igniting passions and tragically often dividing pro-lifer from pro-lifer. So my goal this morning, what I want to do is try to place this debate in the broader context of biblical decision-making, so that this discussion this morning is not just a primer for this one dialogue, but also for evaluating other complex ethical matters. We're going to first look to biblical principles before considering each side of this debate in detail, in a little more detail. And just so you know, while I will briefly provide my position this morning, my goal is not advocacy of one side or the other. What I want to do, what I hope we will do this morning, is to gain a greater understanding of these views and also biblical counsel, as well as a reminder to all of us to show love to one another who may hold views different from our own, but which are also equally biblically ethical. Okay, so elective abortion. This is a morally simple issue when you think about elective abortion. If you want to discuss that topic, all you have to do is establish one principle. It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent humans. And then if you establish that principle, it's really simple. You just show that elective abortion does that. It intentionally kills innocent humans, and you have your conclusion, elective abortion is wrong. That conclusion is unavoidable. But when the topic is more complex morally, we may have to identify multiple biblical themes and principles to provide wider counsel. And our topic this morning that I referenced is one such instance. But what I want to do again, before I jump right into that, what is often a contentious debate, I want to spend a little time on some area where we have general agreement around the room, around the pro-life circle, to help tease out those biblical principles that will help us navigate this ethical matter. So the case I want to begin with is ectopic pregnancy. that tragic situation where the baby implants not where she should in the uterus, but instead somewhere else, usually the fallopian tube. Now, this is truly a dilemma when this happens because the fallopian tube, unlike the uterus, is not designed to grow with the baby. So the baby will eventually become too large, the tube will rupture, mom will hemorrhage and probably die, and baby will die as well. The fact that we oppose abortion does not help us resolve what to do when the mother's life is in danger. That one simple principle does not get to a conclusion for this more complex matter. So instead, we have to look to the wider counsel of God's word. And I'm going to commend four biblical principles to help us navigate this and other complex matters. In Matthew 22, a very familiar passage, a lawyer asks Jesus, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." This here is our first principle for complex decision making, love. In particular, that second commandment, to love our neighbor as ourselves. Now, in Luke 10, we see the lawyer who seeks to shirk responsibility ask Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Now, we don't want to follow his bad motives of resisting responsibility, but love does compel us to ask, in a complex matter, who is in need? We have to identify who are the players involved in this complex matter in need of our assistance. We must first identify them who needs our aid before determining what is the right course of action to help them. So looking back to ectopic pregnancy, there can be no doubt the mother in front of us, that pregnant mother, she is our neighbor and she is in need. But we also recognize another person. Seeing throughout Scripture God's care for social outcasts like orphans and widows, we do not overlook the preborn human in ectopic pregnancy, even if our wider culture does. So we conclude that there are two humans in peril, two humans deserving of our love that we identify, two humans in need of an active response. But what action should we take? Love compels us to do something for these humans, but what should we do? While love can help us identify the players involved, we must look to something else to determine what is the right course of action. And that's our second biblical principle for ethical decision-making, wisdom. Now in Job 28, in the middle of a long speech, as there are many long speeches in that book, we find Job in the middle of a speech entering into a discourse on wisdom. And he envisions God turning to man saying, "The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding." This theme of the fear of the Lord being tied to wisdom is echoed throughout Scripture, such as in Proverbs 9:10, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." Because wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord, determining what is the right thing to do in an ethical dilemma must be guided by awe and respect for the majesty of God. One reason for this is that this will direct and temper our love to ensure that we do not respond to an ethical dilemma with an unethical answer. There's an old action movie, I don't know if any of you know of it, but I remember watching it a long time ago, called John Q, which illustrates this point. It's a Denzel Washington movie where there's a father, Denzel Washington, with a son who his son will die unless the son receives a heart transplant. But the family is dropped from the insurance, and he is denied the procedure. So in classic kick rear Denzel Washington style, John holds up a hospital with a gun, taking innocent people hostage and demanding a heart transplant for his son. There's no question that John Q is motivated out of love for his son. He wants his son to live. We even find out later that his gun was never loaded. He never really meant to harm the hostages, but he still, by his lack of wisdom, puts them in harm's way. This lack of wisdom renders quite dubious John Q's ethics. So wisdom will guard us from unethical action, and wisdom also gives us positive directives for action. So when humans are in distress, like in the case of ectopic pregnancy, reverence for God and for his word directs us to follow biblical commands to liberate these people from their distress. But if it's not possible to rescue mother and child, that does not somehow remove the moral command to rescue. So wisdom leads us to conclude we should do the greatest moral good possible. So that's why we don't stand on the side and let mother and child both die. We take action to save whomever we can. But that leads us to another question, another area, which is pragmatic considerations, our third principle. For which right course of action do we have a reasonable expectation of success? Rescuing mother and child in ectopic pregnancy would certainly be right, but that's not possible for us. There's no expectation of success there. Rescuing mother or child would be preferable to letting both die, but are both of these options equally possible? That's the question we must ask. Do we have a reasonable expectation of success? Now, Jesus demonstrates asking pragmatic questions, or illustrates thinking about pragmatic issues, in the very well-known passage where he talks about the cost of discipleship in Luke 14. Speaking of the cost of discipleship, Christ uses some illustrations. He says, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. Or suppose the king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he at first sit down and consider whether he's able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. Here where Christ is in his illustrations for the cost of discipleship, Christ appeals to asking pragmatic questions before engaging in something to see whether you have a reasonable expectation to finish or to succeed in what you're setting out to do. Of course, this doesn't mean you have to have 100% absolute certainty you will succeed before doing something. But this, I think, means that when faced with various options that wisdom tells you are right, if one of those options has a greater likelihood of success, it makes sense to put your weight behind that. Now imagine our sister, Lizbeth Nelson, strolling down Fairfield Avenue. Now, Lizbeth comes upon two large men who are in the middle of an altercation. Now, love would compel Lizbeth to do something, right? And jumping in the middle, separating victim from victimizer, would be the right thing to do. But there's still a reason that this is not a good solution for Lizbeth. frankly speaking, not to put too fine a point on it, Lizbeth lacks the physical resources to separate two large men in the middle. Well, that's maybe not true. I've seen her in action, actually. But generally, someone of Lizbeth's stature maybe couldn't separate two men like that. But this does not mean Lizbeth should do nothing. It compels her to choose an option where she is more likely to succeed, like maybe pulling out her phone and calling for law enforcement, or calling Silas to come help, maybe. That would take care of it. So returning to ectopic pregnancy, it is not possible to save the child. We lack the technological resources to aid a child at an early stage of development like the children find themselves in this case. But we do have resources to save the mother. So wisdom, combined with pragmatic considerations of the medical reality we face, lead us to conclude we should rescue the mother. Now, some might charge, though, that excluding an option like saving mother and child because of a lack of resources precludes the possibility of divine intervention. And I agree that ethical decision-making should have the door open for the miraculous, even seek miraculous intervention. But in the absence of divine action, I submit we should nevertheless move forward with what we think is the most ethical measure. The final biblical principle then is seeking divine intervention, not necessarily expecting it. In the Garden of Gethsemane before the crucifixion, Jesus pled for an alternate route. Matthew 26, we read this: he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." Matthew 26, 39. Jesus stood at the center of the greatest crisis ever known, that of all mankind found guilty and alienated from God. He knew who was in need of his love, us. He knew what was the right thing to do, rescue us. And Jesus knew he had the resources necessary for success. And he still asked for divine intervention, asked for an alternate route. But when not given an alternate option, he strode forward confidently to resolve the dilemma, to rescue us. So we too, I think, should pray for divine intervention when facing a dilemma or complex matters. But in the absence of the answer, we move forward with the ethical answer. So in the case of ectopic pregnancy, we should pray that God would save mother and child miraculously, save them both. But if he does not, we should still take the ethical option of saving the mother. So our principles then are love, who is in need; wisdom, what is the right thing to do; pragmatic considerations, for which right thing do we have a reasonable expectation of success; and also seeking divine intervention. But enough with areas of agreement. Let's move on with the debate. This may surprise you, but opposing abortion does not necessarily mean we all agree on all things. For example, Wendell and Greg Weaver may both oppose abortion, but only one of them looks really good in Hawaiian shirts. If we're to take a poll, we might disagree on who that is, but I'm not sure, actually. But we probably have disagreement on who looks best in Hawaiian shirts. We don't all agree. So when you come back to the issue of abortion, we all agree abortion is wrong, but we may not all agree on the best model for banning abortion legislatively. And there, as I said, there are two general camps. Important, we must note that both sides of this debate are anti-abortion. Both seek to rescue babies, and like on the Oregon Trail, both pursue the same end goal, crossing the river, banning abortion, getting to that other side. But there is no biblical proof text for anti-abortion legislation, shockingly. So we look to the principles we just covered to serve as guideposts. In so doing, we may recognize there might be a variety of answers which fall between those biblical guideposts and are thus ethical. We must then, to borrow from a liberal co-word, coexist. We should not condemn a brother who takes an alternate yet biblically ethical position. Where we can have certainty, though, is on what falls outside of these guideposts and is therefore not ethical. Like Roe v. Wade, this clearly fails to love the humans in need. This rejects wisdom and thumbs its nose at the Almighty. The only thing I suppose Roe v. Wade has going for it is pragmatism, because the court achieved what they set out to do. But while we can agree to what is not ethical, it may be harder to determine which ethical option is best. We may have to recognize a view we disagree with is nevertheless ethical. I'm not suggesting refrain from debate. Have a hearty, great debate, but show charity to others who have a biblically defended option which may be different from yours. So two camps. One is interchangeably called immediatism or absolutism. Both names, immediatism and absolutism, hint at the philosophy. They call for an immediate, absolute abolition of abortion. Bills which recognize personhood beginning at fertilization and also criminalizing abortion, all abortion, these are immediatist and absolutist measures. This morning, I'm going to use the name absolutism, not because I prefer it, but just to more easily distinguish it from the other camp, which also begins with the letter I. So a philosophical driving force of absolutism is a high view of consistency. This absolutist sees bills like the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, banning abortion at 20 weeks, as undermining the very reason abortion is wrong. Because as we all know, abortion is wrong because it intentionally kills innocent human beings. Whether that human can feel pain is irrelevant to the wrongness of killing that human. So if we invest in educating legislators and moving the public on the point we should not kill babies who feel pain, we are, the absolutist argues, converting them to a false pro-life gospel. And according to the absolutist, if we do succeed and pass these bills, at the very best, we're going to have to re-educate the public again because we said it's wrong to kill babies who feel pain. Well, now we have to re-educate them saying now it's actually wrong to kill babies who maybe have a heartbeat. The absolutist also fears that this kind of re-education over and over could confuse or alienate the public and legislators to the point they may stop listening to us. Absolutist bills, by contrast, are fully consistent. Abortion is wrong. All abortion should be abolished. Now, some absolutists point to biblical examples like Moses' dealings with Pharaoh. When Moses demanded Pharaoh set the Hebrews free, Pharaoh offered compromises, such as allowing the Hebrews to go a little ways in the desert, or only to allow certain genders to go. And each time Moses had an option to compromise, take an incremental choice, he stood strong and demanded freedom for all. Similarly, the absolutist calls opponents of abortion not to bargain with tyrants. And indeed, according to the absolutist, bills falling short of abolishing abortion are not only mixed messages, worse, they regulate the evil instead of eliminating it. And in this way, they legitimize the injustice we want to end. Therefore, the absolutist would agree with the sentiment of saving babies at 20 weeks, but they argue a bill like this implicitly says it's okay to kill babies at 19 weeks. That is an unethical bridge the absolutist refuses to cross. It would be akin to reworking the 14th Amendment to, instead of abolishing slavery, ban only owning male slaves. Now, that would ban some slavery, but to say you can't own male slaves implicitly says you can own women. Reference is often made to Isaiah 10, 1 to 2. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my peoples, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. A bill regulating abortion is taken to be unjust and thus unethical. To say you may not kill babies at 20 weeks, but you can kill those at 19 weeks, is an oppressive decree. The only just law, argues the absolutist, is one which sets all babies free. And this is, I think, why the debate becomes so contentious. Because while this is truly a debate of methodology, many in the camp of absolutism look at their pro-life brothers and sisters on the other side, espousing a view which actually decrees injustice. Understandably, that causes concern. Now, on the other side is incrementalism, sometimes called gradualism. Again, we can take our cue from the name itself. This view embraces increments working toward the greater goal or gradually getting there. The goal is the same of what the absolutist calls for, a ban of all abortion. The increments are a variety of bills restricting, though falling short of, total abolition. So bills banning sex-selective abortion, bills criminalizing killing babies at a certain age or babies with special needs, or bills banning certain types of abortion, like the old partial birth abortion ban or the current dismemberment abortion ban, which would ban dilation and evacuation abortions. These are all examples of incremental bills working toward that goal. Now, philosophically, the incrementalist claims to be an absolutist morally, while opposing all elective abortion, while acting as an incrementalist strategically. If the incrementalist appeals to the wrongness of killing babies who feel pain, this is not meant to be the reason why abortion is wrong, but instead a way to underscore barbarity, tap into sympathies, to move people, legislators, and the public to action. The incrementalist thus sees no conflict in defending the contention all abortion is wrong, because it intentionally kills innocent humans, while endorsing a variety of legislation banning some abortions. And here the incrementalist actually agrees with her absolutist sister that this is indeed compromise. But, the incrementalist argues, it's not compromise from our side. Rather, each bill successfully passed is seen to force the tyrant to compromise. Federal courts have said no preborn child has a right to life, and any bill protecting any number or subset of these preborn victims forces the state to set free some of their victims. The other side, argues incrementalist, is the one compromising, not us. The incrementalist similarly argues that the unjust law was already passed in 1973 with Roe v. Wade. Any bills we pass today to restrain the evil done by that unjust decision then is not to blame for the killing, because the incrementalist sees a difference here. Restraining evil does not entail responsibility for evil. To illustrate, they would say a firefighter who rescues some humans in a burning house is surely not responsible for those who die out of their reach. The fire is to blame. In the same way, incrementalists blame Roe v. Wade for the deaths of babies beyond their reach. Now, some incrementalists point to God's progressive method of revelation as evidence that incremental action cannot by definition be immoral. For example, in the Sermon on the Mount, we see Christ several times build on previous revelation, adding more light and toughening up previously revealed law. In Matthew 5, Christ says, 5 verse 27, "You've heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now, Christ is not abolishing the law prohibiting adultery, but he builds off of this to work to the deeper issue of sexual lust, which may thrive in the heart, even if the body is abstinent. All sexual morality has always been a sin, but God progressively revealed this, providing first the explicit prohibition of extramarital sex before the explicit prohibition of lust. If God works progressively in this way, the incrementalist argues, progressive action must not be construed necessarily as immoral. A few verses down in that same passage, Christ toughens up the law on divorce, which had been relaxed in Moses' day because of the reality of the hardness of the hearts of the people with whom he was dealing. God's direction to Moses then to relax the law did not render marriage less sanctified in Moses' day, but was a reality of the landscape in which Moses was working. And similarly, the incrementalist argues, they have no desire only to save some. This is the reality of the political landscape they're working in, that not all can be saved, but some can. And facing that reality, they think it's best to save some. So faced with these two general philosophies, what we should do is come to the best conclusion we can in light of those biblical principles. Recall we talked about love, who is in need, wisdom, what is the right thing to do, pragmatic considerations, where do you have a reasonable expectation of success, and seeking divine intervention. I'm truly not troubled this morning if you come down to a position different from mine, so long as you have good reason to defend it as falling within biblical guideposts. So personally, I land on a sort of soft incrementalism. I'll show you how I come here in light of our principles, but not for the purpose of advocating my view. What I want to demonstrate is what I think is biblical decision-making in the matter of anti-abortion legislation. You, everyone here who cares, which hopefully all of us do care, should investigate and come to your own conclusion. So first, again, love. We ask, who is in need? Both philosophies ask this question, who is in need of our love? And both philosophies are motivated to take action. There's no question for the absolutists, this is true. They call for all babies to be saved. They clearly love all babies. But I can't discount the love on the side of incrementalism because, unlike absolutism, it has achieved bills which have rescued actual babies' lives. Those who want to investigate this further, I just recommend you look into the work of Dr. Michael New, who's published in State Politics and Policy Quarterly. Just to summarize what he has written, his work, he says this as a summary. Overall, my analysis of a corrected data set of state-level anti-abortion laws, these are all incremental, adds to the sizable body of peer-reviewed research which shows that public funding restrictions, parental involvement laws, and properly designed informed consent laws, again, these are all incremental, not banning all abortion. Dr. New says these all reduce the incidence of abortion. In other words, fewer babies are being killed in light of these incremental laws. So I can't deny there's true love in action. And what about wisdom? I'm not persuaded by appeals to Moses' dealings with Pharaoh because Moses had what we don't have, a promise God gave him at the burning bush that he would bring all the Hebrews out of Egypt, Exodus 3:16-17. But of course, it's certainly possible not all absolutists may bank on that passage. And I don't want to strawman the absolutists who may not lean on that exegetical error. On the positive side, though, wisdom compels me to do what I think is the greatest moral good possible. So if it's not possible to save all babies now, but it's possible to save some, I believe that is a right thing to do. If this church spontaneously ignites, which I think is not possible, I know the construction was very well done here years ago, but if it were to spontaneously catch on fire, and I can't save everyone in this room, that does not remove my obligation to save whomever I can. Because doing the greatest moral good possible is the right thing to do. Now, this might mean, though, as a soft incrementalist, we must take the greatest leap possible, do the greatest, again, moral good possible. So don't leave behind some babies just for the sake of leaving them behind. But I am not persuaded to see that as unethical to construct legislation to rescue those whom we can save. I think that's the same principle we saw earlier in the case of ectopic pregnancy. When you save the mother, that is truly incremental. You're not saving both lives. But the reason for this is not because you don't want to rescue the baby. It's a function of the medical reality of ectopic pregnancy and current technology. I see incremental legislation similarly. It's not that we don't want to rescue all babies, but a function of the political reality, not only that of state houses and Congress, but also the federal courts with whom we are dealing. Now, in pragmatism, though, pragmatic considerations, we do ask, which has the greatest likelihood of success? Again, to return to the fire, if there's a fire in here, I have to ask, I should save someone. Who am I most likely to save? Looking at me, probably not my Uncle Dave. I probably can't carry him out if he's unconscious, but I can save other people. So incrementalists can it's more common on me, reflection on me, Uncle Dave, than you. With bills, we ask, which is likely to succeed? Clearly, incrementalists have succeeded. But I will say that I do part company here somewhat with hardline incrementalists. Because while I see that incrementalists can boast success, I think sometimes they lean a little strongly on things that are a little uncertain. They often argue the Supreme Court will not uphold bills which go too far, that these bills do not have a reasonable expectation of succeeding. I don't reject that on its face, looking at the current court. But I do recognize some other things. It can take a long time for a case to get before the court. I also recognize we've had surprises before with judicial decisions, so we can certainly make our best predictions of what would happen, But the court makeup or the opinions of individual justices could look radically different in a year or two. And so at minimum, this gives me caution and prevents me from condemning or thwarting the efforts of absolutist brothers and sisters who hold a different position. And similarly, when it comes to seeking divine intervention, while current political realities may drive me to put most of my weight behind incremental bills, I certainly want to be open for and even seek divine intervention for bills that I thought would fail, or for changing the Supreme Court, for Providence to change the court to allow for upholding of bills we never thought would pass, or for in some other way we can't foresee divinely intervening to save more babies than we thought was possible, or even certainly abolishing all abortion now. I'm not going to expect or count on divine intervention unless I stumble on a burning bush in Columbus, and it's not after a recent Buckeye loss, I guess. But I certainly will seek for that. And I, again, will not stop my brother from advancing a bill which, from my very limited vantage point, seems to have little hope of success. And indeed, sometimes I've supported bills which do seem to have little hope of success. Several years ago, Ohio first introduced, for the first time, the heartbeat bill that would ban abortions when the heartbeat can be detected, which is about 5 weeks after fertilization. Not when the heart begins to beat, but when you can detect that with ultrasonography. We testify for the bill, and this actually upset both sides. Incrementalists accused us of going too far too fast. Absolutists said you weren't going far enough because life begins before 5 weeks. But even though that bill failed that year, I was shocked by the far reach of the educational power of the political debate. The public was so amazingly educated all of a sudden by this debate happened within our state house. On the streets of Columbus, after the bill was introduced, I was shocked how many suddenly knew the heart beats early in pregnancy. People used to think it was far later, but now in Columbus, they recognize it must be far earlier than they previously thought. This speaks to the educational power for bills which may be absolutist or may go a lot farther than incrementalists would like to begin or think they can begin. So, of course, the same could be said, though, for very, very modest incremental bills, which do get signed into law, but which seem to be so modest, they wouldn't have much legislative action. Amherst professor Hadley Arkus has written of this in his book, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. Arkus notes that extremely modest bills, such as ones that save babies born alive from botched abortions, even though that may rescue very few, only those few babies who actually are born alive after attempted abortion, that may only save a few by law, that has great educational power because now the public hearing of this realizes legally babies are being killed so late that they can be born alive from it. And that can have far-reaching power to awaken consciences and again move people to action. So we can't discount that educational power. Okay, so we've covered a fair amount of ground this morning, so let's see if we can summarize. There is internal debate within the anti-abortion community about the best legislative path to saving babies. Absolutism calls for an immediate abolition of abortion. Incrementalism embraces increments along the path to abolition. My basic contention this morning is whichever camp you lean toward, evaluate your position according to biblical principles of decision-making. Consider love. Who is in need? Wisdom. What is the right thing to do? Pragmatic considerations. For which right option do you have a reasonable expectation of success? And remain open to seek divine intervention. And again, back to the pragmatic considerations, I would just, as a side note, say that issue there is a broader debate that I don't have time for this morning because there are great debates on both sides. Even though we have seen success with incremental bills, the absolutist does have reasons to argue that they could succeed if people were behind them. And finally, I've argued show charity to brothers and sisters who hold an alternate, yet though biblically, also biblically ethical position. So to conclude, let's turn to football. Now, I know that willingly engaging a sports analogy is unwise for someone like me who can quickly show his ignorance, but I have a solution. We'll just talk about football incrementally, and that will help me avoid things I don't understand. Several years ago during the Super Bowl, I can't remember who was playing that year, but Mark Harrington, Create Equals president, watching the game, mused on Facebook about the nature of the game, by which in football yards are gained incrementally. Mark posted online, football games, as in the battle of abortion, are won one play at a time, speaking to the incremental nature of the action. Now, in response, Don Cooper, a leading absolutist, published a blog piece to challenge Mark's interpretation of the game. But in my opinion, what Don did was provide a powerful illustration of the common ground shared by all in this absolutism-incrementalism debate. Speaking again of the Super Bowl, Don writes, "On every play, whether you run up the middle or throw a long pass, the goal and potential is to score. There is no running play that is purely incremental. I guarantee every good running back has on his mind to go through a hole all the way to the end zone." Don's point was, even if football looks incremental, it's truly an effort to get all the way to the end goal. There is no action of football that is truly incremental. And as a soft incrementalist, I couldn't agree more. Every good anti-abortion legislator on every play wants to get all the way to the end goal. He is not an incrementalist willingly, in the same way the running back doesn't stop short of the end zone willingly. Both stop short because of realities outside of their control. Don's illustration, then, is, I think, again, evidence of both sides of the camp, incrementalists, absolutists, both want to get to the same place, that end goal. Again, which is the better path to success is a debate of politics, which is beyond my pay grade, and we don't have time for it this morning anyway. In the same way, I don't have time this morning to wax eloquent on why caulking the wagon and floating across is superior to the rookie mistake of fording the river or the elitist strategy of paying for a ferry. But I do think that all of us can and all of us should apply biblical principles of decision-making daily as we approach not only this debate, but also many other complex matters of ethical issues.